Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Nicholas Davenport, a.k.a. Mr. Mental Muscle on the Mental Muscle Podcast. And we have Johnny Dixon. You may know him from No Lab Coat Required. He's been on this channel a few times before, and I'm happy to have him back. So I won't go too much into a spill because we're going to do this a little bit different, not such as a podcast, but we're just going to talk about some different topics. And hey, you might learn something. So you can give him a little breakdown for those who may not know you, but let's get into it.
I'm glad to be back, Mr. Mental Muscle. If you have not seen any of my content, I consider myself an expert student. So my thing is reaching my little hands into the world of academia and extracting out information that we could use. I have a heart for people who are newly health conscious. So a lot of my teachings and a lot of my videos have to do with trying to dismantle the complexity of a lot of these topics and really just break it down bare bones and say, hey, this is the mechanism behind this thing, and this is how you can use it to be a little bit healthier. And it's a blast, man. It's a lot of fun. So that's what I do.
So to get into it, that actually is a perfect segue, because one of the topics we said we might cover today is creativity. And I think your channel, No Lab Coat Required, is a perfect example of this, because like you said, you're getting health tips, facts, and this is nothing new. Health tips and the health industry has been booming probably since the late 80s. That's when it kind of became a industry per se. Before that, it was more like bodybuilders and people like that. But around the 80s, it got into like the step aerobics, the jazzercise. And then the 90s, it started to get into more like running with like Nike. And then 2000, you got CrossFit. And now we have Orange Theory. We have Peloton. The list really goes on, right? But to get to my point, you bring it to the masses in a way where it's educational, like you said, but it's not going to be that, oh, studies have shown. And that's one of the biggest things I have a beef with the health or just the performance industry and all, is you have all these eggheads who are scientists, and it's not wrong with that. I have degrees, you have degrees, but they'll give you all these citations, all these studies, and leave you with that and say, hey, this is what it is, figure it out. Then you got the practitioners who's got all the motivation to rah-rah, but they're not really breaking down what you need to do. So you're that perfect middle ground, because you're giving the info, but you're doing it in a creative, fun way. So how do you go into making an episode? Because when we talk about creativity, it's not just about being out of the box, but it's also being out of the box while still entertaining and making sense.
Yeah, and still providing value. That's an excellent question. For me, creativity is it's an interesting thing, because when people ask for me, and they ask of me my job title, for example, I don't say content creator. I rarely say content creator. I rarely use that word to even describe myself, but at the end of the day, that's what I do. I just never considered myself creative. And I think I check a certain box for people. I scratch a certain itch, because a lot of the folks that do communicate health via media, like you said, it's been going on since the 80s, and there's always this health promotion. But in current day, there isn't a lot of people that seem to be having fun while doing it. I think of even the people who I've learned a lot from in terms of when I became newly health conscious, and I started to just Google certain things, like what the heck is even a carbohydrate and why should it matter? How do I prevent myself from getting a dad bod? What, you know, the things that come up, they are good and they're valuable, but they don't keep me, because they're void of personality a lot of times. It's just, like you said, a bunch of eggheads preventing information. And that has its place. And I get very nitty gritty sometimes and super scientific. So sometimes I am the egghead, but I know that can't exist. Me personally, it wouldn't be genuine if that was the only thing that existed. Like, there has to be both. There has to be that personality in it as well. And I think if you stand on your principles, for me, like, I have the principle of checking myself. Like, I can make sure, I have to make sure there's no bias in my work, right? It's really hard to, you can't be like 0% biased, but I really do a strong bias check on myself. On top of that, I make sure that I'm continually learning, and I make sure that I'm providing value, and I'm driven by that alone, that I'm not driven by money or driven by being right. I'm always checking myself on that kind of know-it-all-ism. So those are just like a brief overview of my principles. And I think when you stay on your principles, then it allows for you to have a more authentic version of your creativity, right? And I think that's what's going to end up having people last a lot longer. And that's why I'm very bullish of my future and looking forward to what's coming, because I think I've been able to establish the principles, stand on them, and say, hey, I guess in this regard, I can call myself a content creator. You know what I mean?
So going off of that, that's a perfect example. And I got to reference your page, even though you're not a content creator, but you are, but you're not, but you're more than that, because you actually go above and beyond than just giving us some videos. Your videos, and I'm biased because, like, so you got to check your bias. I'm checking my bias. That's how I first find you. I saw one of your videos, and as a practitioner, I was very moved and informed by it and learned some things too, because I can never know everything, right? But going to my point of creativity, your thumbnails, let's go with that. I saw a video on your Instagram a few weeks ago, and you were just going behind the scenes of you getting the right shot, the right angle, and I'm the same way. So that in itself shows your creativity, because when you make content, you have to draw people in, and your thumbnails are very good. They're not over the top like the cliche ones with the crazy eyes, or, you know what I mean? You do stuff that's like, it makes a point with the title, but it's a little like, oh, it's kind of interesting picture you got there with the face on the object, or you have like a dash of salt on the table. And it's like, but you just do things in a way where people say, oh, creativity is something you have or you don't, which is not true. It's not innate. And you even said it yourself, you wouldn't outwardly say you're a creative person, but I, from what I do with my business, Mind by the One, it's a skill. And how does that go to you? Because you had to learn this stuff. So how do you develop your creativity and just overall skills in that manner?
When I think of my journey in terms of getting to where I am now, I think it's, and I think to add on to that, actually, part of the reason I don't say I'm a content creator is because what I do and the information I involve myself with, it's so scientific. It almost seems like this universe that I'm in, it has nothing to do with creativity. We're talking about cells right now. We're talking about muscle cells. We're talking about adipose tissue. We're talking about the liver. Like, what does this have to do with creativity? I think because I'm always in that world, it's like, I have this information to present. This has nothing to do with creativity, right? But you're right. I don't actually consider the amount of thought that goes into a thumbnail, the amount of thought that goes into how I'm going to edit a certain thing. Like, I actually have the most fun editing my videos, and people don't enjoy editing. Like, I actually like going into that DaVinci Resolve program and picking apart like certain clips and making it funny, adding the music at certain points. Like, that lights me up. And to answer your question about building it up and almost it's like a skill, I didn't start off well. Like, you can go to my page right now and you can hit the latest or the oldest sort the videos by oldest, and my oldest video, you can see the difference between that and my latest video. Like, it's a jarring difference, and you can see the progression if you just watch from oldest to newest, the progression in terms of my editing and my camera presentation. Like you said, these are creative skills that need to be built up, right? I think for some people it comes to them a little easier, right? But for me, I had to learn. I mentioned I use DaVinci Resolve. Like, they say the trick to using DaVinci Resolve, it's a complicated editor. They say it's an amazing editor. It rivals Premiere Pro. But the thing is, you got to learn how to edit. And that was my process. It's like, I want to be able to produce these videos, but I actually have to learn how to edit. So with anything, it's a built skill, and practice over time can get you to where you need to be. And there was a time, because if we're talking about skill building and practice, of course you have to make sure it's the right type of practice, right? We talked about that a little bit before we even got on the call. It's like, you can do a bunch of something, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing. So I can't remember who said it, but they said perfect practice makes perfect progress. You know what I mean? That's what actually builds the skill. So I remember there was a time where I was kind of just mashing buttons and getting my editing done that way. But it wasn't until I decided to say, hey, I'm going to use these hotkeys to be a little bit more efficient. Now I'm practicing the right way. And that goes with anything, right? Whether it's creative or even less creative. It's like, make sure it's actually applicable to you progressing and getting it better, you know?
So that's a good point. I want to hold it there and come back to it, but I'm going to bring it up so I can remember it. But you mentioned the perfect practice. So there's a guy, K. Anders Ericsson. He died a few years ago. He was a psychologist who's the father of what he called deliberate practice. And the famous 10,000 hour rule was born out of that. But we'll come back to that. I want to backtrack just a little bit with something called analogical thinking. Are you familiar with that term?
No, break it down for me.
So like an analogy, right? You use something to describe something else as an example, right? So the premise is, combining all your, say, life experiences, knowledge, work, whatever credentials, and using that to solve problems. So for example, you could say like the person who made Steve Jobs, they made the iPod, right? The goal was to take the logic or the thought of music, but a computer, and they put that together from two different industries and made the iPod. And then eventually that became the iPhone. So it's basically just taking different concepts from whatever it may be, whether it's your own experience or something you learn, to make the solution, because that's really what creativity, in my opinion, is: solving problems by generating different ideas. Like, for example, I used to do this when I taught this lecture back in the day. The first people wanted to fly, they probably said, oh, it's a bird. Birds flap their wings. Let's flap our arms, jump off a mountain. But guess what? You died. And then eventually it's like, okay, we don't have feathers, right? And let's say this is 20,000 years ago, and they're like, let's put feathers that we find from birds, put them on our arms, then jump off the mountain and flap our wings or arms. Still died. And that process went on for probably 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years until the Wright brothers come along. They say, wait, you need to be lighter than air. So all that other stuff does matter. So they weren't wrong. They understood how birds flew, but they didn't understand the physics of they're very light and hollow. Therefore, they can get lighter than air when they flap their wings. And then the Wright brothers put that together. And eventually, with the speed of the wheels that they made from being bike experts, they made a plane. It didn't go super high. It didn't go super fast. I think it went like 25 miles per hour. Respect for that time. Now we got planes going like 800 miles per hour, right? So that's basically analogical thinking. Taking what you know from other fields, like you have different backgrounds and you use those. Like you probably weren't an editor before, but some of your skills from all your other things make you edit a certain way that makes it more interesting or creative, or your videos that hit different. So that's generally what analogical thinking is.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be more cognizant of that when I'm coming up with stuff. What came to mind is how I almost always, to get a point across and to make sure it really stamps in the memory of someone that I'm trying to teach, is I use a reference outside of the subject matter. So for example, there's this thing that the body does to prepare us to intake food. It's called the cephalic phase. It's a brief period when you see food, smell food, or think of food, and then it's strongly activated when you actually taste the food that's in your mouth. It's basically a period of physiological adjustments to prepare you to intake food. So it's an anticipatory response, and it's saying, I expect you to eat. This is what we're going to do physiologically to prepare for that. And that all makes sense, good and well, sure, when you break it down that way. But I think it really clicks when I can tell somebody that, hey, this cephalic phase is a lot like starting an old car in the wintertime before driving it, just to get the heat warmed up, just to get in that car and you don't hear those old car noises that you hear, right? Like, they say you don't have to warm up your car anymore. I don't know how true. I'm not a mechanical guy like that, but I do know that back then we warmed our cars up. So that reference makes a lot more sense, and it clicks a lot easier for people. And it almost makes more sense. It's paradoxical, because it almost makes more sense when you relate it to a field outside of what you're talking about versus relating it back to the body. So if I say the cephalic phase is a lot like chewing before swallowing, it makes sense, but it's just like, I don't think the connection to memorizing it is going to be as deep as saying, hey, it's just like warming up your car, right? So I think that would be an instance of where I'm almost using separate instances and using that analogy to further teach a point.
No, that's exactly what it is. And you hit it on the money, because in my years of teaching too in the classroom, I do the same thing. And you're right, it hits harder because people want practicality. This kind of veers back to what we were talking about with the, I don't want to keep calling them eggheads, but the eggheads that will put out all this information through studies. And because the reason I'm biased or maybe judgmental of it, because I did come from that world as well as being in the practical field. So I've walked both lines. But what I see a lot, and you probably see this on your social media too, they're becoming, I don't want to say it, but hey, I'm going to say it, kind of like the new snake oil salesmen, because they'll cite the study, then insert practice and or product that they're pushing. And guess what? Since they have doctor in front of their name or PhD after their name or whatever it is, it gets taken in. We just get all this information, which is great. But I see people who don't understand this at a deep level reciting this stuff to me, who does understand it. And I don't say anything. I always keep my mouth shut because I don't interject, but I'll hear it. I'm like, wait, that's not what that means. So they'll take it and run with it. So that's why I think that's a problem. And going back to using the analogies and examples, it makes it digestible for someone who didn't do a master's or a doctorate. And it's something that they definitely know. They know what a car is. Even if they're not, like you said, not a mechanic, you can understand, oh, you got to get the engine revved up a little bit before it goes. And then it heats up and gets to where it needs to be and it runs. I can get that. But if you say the certain systems and certain glands involved, like now you're losing them on other jargon that they didn't know in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that jargon is really what gets people, because this is so crazy, dude. Cause I was just talking, I just talked to Dr. Ken Berry. He's big on YouTube. Are you familiar?
I'm not familiar.
You probably know his face. I'd be shocked if you didn't know his face.
The name sounds familiar.
But Dr.
though.
Ken Berry. Yeah. Dr. Ken Berry just told me that it's an interesting thing going on the internet right now. They're, like you said, they're the new snakes oil salesmen, but it's interesting how they do this, because they take their conceived expertise and they take it to a specific subject that has to be just complex enough for them to seem like they have the solution to it. And their solution to it is often tied to them fattening their pockets. Mm-hmm. So it's some type of supplement they want to push or some type of course that they want to sell. And I've realized, sure, we care about people's background and their education, but a lot more times we care about people's intentions way more than what their background is. So I'd urge anybody who's just scrolling on the internet, because that's how they get us, is you have to be hyper-vigilant of what their intentions are. And if you feel like you can't find their intentions, right? Like I write my intentions on my wall. I say my intentions in every video. Hey, I hope you gained some nuance out of this. I hope you learned. I have it in my bio. I have it on my about page. It's like, if you can't find that from the person you're extracting information from, you should pause and be like, wait a minute. I'm pulling out my credit card. I need to find out why I feel the urge to do this. Like, what problem is this solving? And I think that's part of the reason. If you just take the supplement industry, for example, supplements are so compelling to buy in the moment because of we hear of what they do. It's crazy how it works. I was just talking about how, shout out to my mom. I was just talking about how vitamin K works with blood clotting and all this other stuff with my mom. And she was like, oh, I need some vitamin K supplements. And I was like, well, no, you don't necessarily. I was just talking about how they work. And I don't know what it is necessarily about the human mind that makes us want to buy into it. But the moment we hear this is something that helps this, aka some supplement, it's like, oh, I want that. And I'm going to go buy that. Right. And I think we do waste a lot of money buying useless stuff because of that. And I do think there are some people that take advantage of that because they know that's how we operate. That's how we think, you know.
I don't want to say it, but I'm going to say it. I think some people are just lazy at the end of the day, because it's not lazy in the sense of they don't want to work, but it's like, if I have option A, hard exercise, being mindful of what I put into my body food wise and otherwise, or a so-called supplement that overgeneralize a complex, because they don't always outwardly lie. Sometimes they're not wrong. It's just they're magnifying what it actually does 100. It's like vitamin C, right? That's probably the biggest one, right? I forget, was it Airborne or something like that, where the lady who invented it, she marketed it as like, oh, I was a teacher and kids get sick all the time and I was always around them. Therefore, I take this vitamin C, which is good for immune function. But it turned into like, oh, you take Airborne or forget the other one, Emergency, and you won't get sick when you feel the sniffles coming. And it's like, oh, shoot, let me take 10 million milliunits or whatever. And it's like, maybe you just should eat foods with vitamin C and you'll have that same effect. But it's easier to be like, here's my pill when I think I need it, versus no, just live a normal life and have a regular diet and you got it.
Exactly. Febreze, I think of the origin story of how Febreze became
know about that one.
Successful. So Febreze was having a hard time launching and actually being successful in their early years. For those that would be unfamiliar with Febreze, for some apparent reason, it's when you have your spray bottle and you spray it, it smells good and it freshens up the room. So they were having trouble launching and being a good company at the start, or having high sales at the start, because they couldn't have a good story behind their brand. And they started using the trick of association, which is what we are susceptible to as humans. Association is when you essentially make two separate things agreeable. So when one thing turns into a cue, you are able to then respond to the cue. So it's a cue and response mechanism. Mm-hmm. So Febreze, it was a great product, eliminates the odor, but they couldn't get people to buy it off the shelves. So what they did was they made a commercial about spraying Febreze after you clean up. So instead of masking a smell or any other scenario, you'd use a smell good spray. They said, hey, use this after you clean up. And now every time you clean up, there's this association to give it a couple spritz in the air because now it's clean. It's like you don't even feel like your place is clean until you take out that Febreze after you've cleaned the room. And next thing you know, this commercial goes out and the Febreze is flying off the shelves and people are continually buying it because every time they clean, now they have to spray Febreze to get that clean sense. And the power of association is what drives a lot of our actions. So when you say, you think a lot of people are lazy, I agree too. I actually just posted something on my story and I deleted it. I went on a mini rant about people being lazy, but I deleted it because I realized nobody cared. But I think it's one of the plagues of our time, especially now for this generation, because we have so many things at our fingertips that's just calling for our attention and distracting us. But really, if I could make it make even more sense, this kind of a plague of laziness, I think it has a lot to do with the level of inconvenience we experience. So if you think about people who achieve a lot of stuff, they just embrace inconvenience a lot more than those who don't, right? There's a spectrum. There's a spectrum. Those of us that embrace inconvenience more tend to get things more done and achieve more things than folks who are more averse to inconvenience. And it's essentially humans naturally take the path of least resistance. And because of that, it is a lot easier to just see a headline and say, hey, this is going to help me in this thing. And they just buy. But there isn't any legwork to check up on the details or the context or actually read the study. It's just this thing is in my face and it makes sense right now. So let me go ahead and give them my money, right? And I think that's one of the biggest problems right now.
So many things on that was, one, you taught me some things with the Febreze and I'm guilty of that, spraying it. And I didn't even had a boom moment when you said it. I'm like, dang, I do that. And I don't even think about why. It's just like, oh, I just mopped up everywhere. I wiped down the counters. Get the Febreze, and then I do it.
Association.
Yeah, so it's just so much to that. But yeah, going to the other points, it's just that, like you said, like one, people do these things and they don't know why, or they want the least inconvenience they can go through. And I like how you said the people who do overcome, become what we call greatness, they're okay with that inconvenience. You know, I word that similarly, but I like how you worded it just there. I'm going to have to start using that. I'm going to clip that for sure. Still, but yeah. So, man, this is some good stuff. We're only 20 minutes in, but let's segue you, because this kind of goes perfectly to the next part, since you say people who achieve greatness are okay with inconvenience. So we mentioned a little bit when you talked about like practice and becoming better. So let's go back to that thing I mentioned with deliberate practice, the Anders Ericsson guy. So said the 10,000 hour rule. I'm sure you probably heard about that. That's probably one of the most overused terms. And when it comes to peak performance, and his book is actually called Peak. But 10,000 hour rule, for those who don't know, is if you do anything 10,000 hours, you'll become a master. And they took that and ran with it. And like you said, it can't just be doing anything just because. It has to be intentional, has to be structured, has to have critical like assessment of, is it improving? It's not just saying, like, I'll use an analogy, racing a car, right? I'm not Jeff Gordon. If I went on a NASCAR, I'm 35. I've been driving since I was 17, so almost 20 years. I can't go to NASCAR and win, because you can say, what, Nick, you've driven for 20 years, but I wasn't going 200 miles per hour with 40 other cars on a track that's probably almost the size of a two, maybe interstate lane. So it's like, that's not the same versus Jeff Gordon, who's been driving at that. So that deliberate practice has to be there. So going to that, on your journey, and it doesn't even have to just be with your channel, but in general in life, like how do you see how you became, like you're a track athlete, you're a fitness trainer, all the things you've done, how have you put in that work, that deliberate practice, whether it was reassessing your good, your bad, the ugly, having outside factors tell you, hey, that wasn't good, need to pick it up, or being able to say, man, I got to keep practicing even when it doesn't feel good or when I'm bored, that monotony, whatever it may be. So how'd you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't spend a lot of time in my comments because of that reason. I actually am my biggest critic. I naturally just criticize the things that I do, nitpicky of the small, the big, at all. Like, I'm sure after this conversation, I'm going to be able to look back and be like, I should have said that. And it, I just, you know, that's natural. But in order to, I'll say this, for as technical as the conversations that I have online, with health science and things like that, I'm actually not the most, I'm not the most efficient learner. In a lot of regards, I call myself slow. In a lot of regards, I need to go and like reteach what I just sat through. So through college, I didn't learn like as I was sitting in the class. A lot of the time I had to go and take the information back to my dorm, sit down and kind of relearn or kind of bare bones teach myself what I just sat through in that lecture, because I can't connect the dots as somebody's trying to teach me in real time. I just was never really able to click on and latch on to the information in a meaningful way until I had that separate time where I was deliberately learning bare bones and teaching myself and building the foundation that way. And that's, I found out, is when it sticks the most for me. So you relate that to my attitude toward it. It's more so my level to apply myself. So when you think about building something up, like a YouTube channel, for example, you think about putting in the deliberate practice, the 10,000 hours, you have to first agree with yourself that this is something you're going to apply yourself to, right? I am a decent cook, but I'm not Gordon Ramsay, because I didn't choose for that to be my 10,000 hour of mastery, right? I am sure I could probably pull off what he pulls off, but I didn't choose to practice in that area. I chose to practice in this area. So for me, the way I was able to kind of keep going and stay focused is I didn't really get caught up into the results. So a lot of my early days, when the view counts were low, there was no money coming in, and you know, there's discouragement around every corner. You can't get caught up in the results. I didn't get caught up in the results. I told myself, on to the next. So I'd put a video out, and I mean, immediately within the next hour, I'd be working on the next video without even checking in on the results, checking in on anything, because I understood that the process is what matters. If I don't have the muscle to build this up and get as far as I can, putting in the reps now when there's nobody here, that's going to be questionable when somebody is here. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull this off in the same regard. So I'm building the strength now. And I think if you actually want to do anything that's worth achieving, you have to get used to that concept that nobody's going to be here early on. Nobody is checking for you. And fall in love with doing it anyways. Fall in love with making the video and then the next video and then the next video and then the next video. And I told myself, be willing to get to 100 videos, fully produced, fully thought out, fully researched videos without a single dollar, without a single 100 viewed video. And once I told myself, okay, I agree, I can do that. Once I told myself that, it was just a matter of putting them out, because I knew I'm keeping this thing going. Because if I reach 100 videos and I haven't gotten to where I want to be, then this just isn't for me. I could say that. But I'm not going to allow the lack of desired results in this moment to be what discourages me from the long-term journey, you know? So I think for me personally, that's definitely what got me to where I needed to be.
Now, I made a video about this topic more in depth a few months ago, and you literally, in a different words, said exactly what I was talking about. And that's all part of it. When you talk about the deliberate practice and the 10,000 hours, that actually, how they got to that number, he actually gave his rationale. So it's approximately 3 hours a day, every day for 10 years. Hmm. So essentially, you'll build up to it. So it can happen faster, it can happen slower, depending on how you load up, right? So it's not necessarily 10,000 hours. It could be 20,000 hours if you do it at a slower pace. But basically, the premise is you have to be doing things that, like you said, they may not yield result immediately. It may be something that's monotonous, tedious. You said 100 videos. I would argue that like most people won't even do 20 videos before they feel that, dang, is this for me? And I feel 100 is definitely a lot. But I think if you did you do 100 before you? Is that a real life example before you got monetized?
I did get to a decent amount, but I didn't get to 100. Because they also, this is also a YouTube secret. You usually pop around 35. Like if you're actually doing YouTube the correct way, you're probably going to pop at about 35 videos of like I said, you know, you take care of your packaging, you take care of your subject matter, and you're actually delivering value. You can probably take off in about 35 videos. But I knew I had to dedicate myself to about 100. I can't remember exactly where I got. Because the thing that YouTube does is shows you like your shorts in that number too. So I don't know how many exact videos, but I know right now I'm sitting at about 115-ish videos, and I didn't really say I was where I wanted to be until maybe 7 videos ago. close to 100.
Well, to be fair,
with shorts included, you'd say.
Well, to be fair with you and channels like yours or similar to yours, I would call there needs to be some inflation for that, because your videos are more in detail and take a little more production value. Like, let's say, for example, something, and it's not talking down to these types of channels, but let's be real. There's some channels where they can get away with 2 minutes of just, let's say it's more of a comedy channel. And that doesn't make it any worse because we all need laughter. I love comedy channels. But they're going to be able to just turn on the camera. It doesn't have to be the greatest camera for 2 minutes, be funny, which is hard. It's not easy. And then boom, you hit 35 videos versus you. 35 videos for you takes a lot of one, research, first and foremost. Two, you're not shooting one straight shot. You have a lot of transitions. You have overlays with things that are relevant to the pictures or documents from the research. So all in all, one video, one 19 minute, I think your videos flow between 15 to 45, depending on the subject.
Yeah, exactly.
But exactly, right? So it's like one video for you is really like 6 videos, low key.
That's a great point. I totally agree. I would say that that number is definitely not concrete because, and then also you got to think about the rate at which people are able to produce the videos. There's a lot that goes into it. But I think the main ingredient is, if we're talking YouTube specifically, or really any platform, is understanding your lane and who your audience is. I figured that out at a very early stage, and I knew like I serve the newly health conscious. So I started using vocabulary and language that would serve the newly health conscious, because when I was newly health conscious, I knew what I wanted to hear and what I wanted to see. So it's like, oh, let me provide that. And I think a lot of people could find gold in that if they think about the problems they have, and your opportunity and capacity to solve that is going to actually be what catapults you to where you want to be, you know?
That term newly health conscious, did you coin that? I like that. Or did you hear someone?
I don't know if I've heard it be used like, I wouldn't say coin, but I think I did kind of come up with that without hearing anybody else say it. Yeah.
If you didn't invent it, I would say like you probably popularized it in the sense of your videos you target, because that's a perfect way to describe your audience. And the reason I like that, because going back to what I said about the science and PhD guys or people who push health stuff, they don't do that. I got to beat that dead horse some more, because I actually call out, because I have some of those people in my circle. And I will say, hey, by the way, I think ... And since we know each other, they'll give me their criticism and feedback. I'll never do it to a stranger, though. I would never just, hey, I think you're just doing the most. Like, nah, but I'll ask the people I know. I'm like, hey, you think you could have came off like this? And they're like, yeah, I guess I could. But they're not like trying to shill or anything like that. But they do cross that line of being over the top jargon or oversimplifying more complex when they bring up things like testosterone, estrogen, circadian rhythm. These are all popular terms. If you go Google them, a million hits are going to come up, but they're deeper than just saying, oh, testosterone, it's the male hormone. Estrogen, it's the female hormone. Circadian rhythm, that's your body's internal clock. Okay, now what? Most people aren't going to be able to say further than that. So it's like, you can't just be sort of newly health conscious. I like that term. So yeah, I'm sorry using these things. I'm going to give you the props. Even if
steal them, man, steal them. But yes. Because I when I was newly health conscious, I mean, I'm literally, I remember, because I was in college when I became curious of how I could be more healthy. And I consider that like my newly health conscious time, because it's a period, and most people will know when they started to take their health more serious. But it was a period of time where I found myself like in my free time, just in the library, and I was just Googling bare bones stuff. Like, what the heck is a carbohydrate? It's a starch. What the heck is a starch? What does starch do to you? This breaks down into what, glucose? What do we need glucose for? So it was like, I mean, I'm breaking these subjects down naked to where it's like, I need to understand them this way. That way I can understand the foundation and kind of build on that. And I mean, that's where I got everything. My ability to kind of sit down, hone in, and kind of teach myself and learn in that regard. So
that perfectly goes into this topic we talked about, learning styles, because I was a teacher for some years at the college level, high school, even middle school. And one thing people talk about all the time is, oh, I'm more of a auditory learner, or I'm more of a visual learner, or I'm more of a hands-on kinesthetic learner. And what research has shown us, like, I'm gonna play the research card, but I'm gonna give you the practical too. It's all the above. Like, no one learns one way. You might have a preferred learning style, but imagine if you only were told auditorily directions and that's it. You weren't given any visual examples. You didn't have a practical hands-on example. You may prefer to hear it and just go with the flow, or you might prefer to see it and go with the flow, but we don't only do one. So I think it got like oversimplified once again and people just ran with it. So going to learning styles. So this comes full circle, I guess, to all we're talking about. When you're presenting your information, you do a very good job. You do visually show us, you give us the text, the auditory, and then obviously we're going to get some practical examples through your actual examples in the videos. So what are your thoughts on like learning styles? Do you have a preferred one, or did you believe in the one only myth, or what's your thoughts on those things?
I remember when I was shown the learning styles, and it was in a classroom, and I immediately thought, I need all three of those. I need all three. I'm not just listening, I'm not just watching, and I'm not just doing. I need all three. And I knew that was my case personally because of my level of self-awareness at the time. I was like, I wouldn't just be able to get away with getting good grades if I was focusing on just one of those. So I think we have a certain amount of stock in each one. And I think that's fair to say for each human. Like you said, that's what the research shows, and it makes the most sense. And I think about, for me personally, I have to go do it. So if I learn how to change a tire, when I first learned how to change a tire, I was sitting in my mechanics class back in high school, and my teacher, he's breaking down, hey, this is what we're going to do. This is how you do it. He's expressing it. He's telling me, I hear it, I see it. And then I'm like, nice. I don't know if I would have been able to save my couple times getting pulled over because I got a flat tire and I had to get on the shoulder. I don't know if I would have been able to save myself if that's all I did in that classroom that day. I needed to go learn and actually go change the tire myself. And I think for me personally, that builds a way more concrete neural pathway in my brain where it's like, this works this way now. And I think that is, like I said, part of the reason I am able to communicate in the way that I do is because I spent the time trying to learn this for myself. Like I said, I consider myself a little slow. So it's like, I am the weakest at auditory learning. If you try to break a concept down to me and you're just kind of telling me how it works, it's like, I'll give you a perfect example. At a game night with your friends, when people try to like explain the instructions of a card game nobody ever played, I'm probably sitting there and I don't have a single clue of like, what are you even talking about? What is this like? Okay, is this goldfish? Are we playing spades? How is this going to work? And they could be explaining it the best way they can, but until I actually play the game, I get nowhere. So I think it's a level of strength in terms of learning for each person. And then there's so many ways you can hack the way you learn. There are so many ways that you can hack the way you learn. I have a book, it's probably laying around here, but it essentially talks about how to learn. And there's things like spaced repetition. There's things like recall. And essentially quizzing yourself is like the most powerful way to make information stick. And I'm doing that on a continuous basis. Like I'm continually studying, I'm continually recalling and all these other things to make sure the information that I want to retain is actually sticking with me. So I think there's ways to hack it, and you're going to limit yourself if you focus on just one way. It's like somebody's talking to you. You're like, no, I got to see it. It's like, no, get all three, do it, see it and hear it. Right. So I think that's kind of a limited way of viewing how you can grow in your knowledge. So that's what I'd say to that.
Nice. And I agree. And it's like a lot of people don't practice these things either. Once they get past, you know, school age, you know, 18 years old, unless you go to college. And even if you go to college after 22-ish, you're not really doing much of these things repetitiously. Like if you're the person who says, I'm a visual learner, you're probably never going to even give thought to trying to be more hands-on or more auditory. You're just going to always go, I got to see it. I got to see it, because there's no need to. Like I had someone I was talking to the other day, and we were just joking around because we're saying how most people after high school or whatever, maybe in college, they don't ever have to do anything that requires this type of thing. I'm not saying they don't think. Obviously, whatever job you do, whether it's high or low tier, you're thinking, you're doing something, but the demand that's needed, like they're not like us. We're going to read a research article, maybe not for fun necessarily, but we're not going to be mad at it. We're going to be like, oh, cool. All right. I can understand that. Or we might write something out just because of the joy of we like to do it, or the editing the video. These are just things that we find joy in that most people would not be doing unless a classroom told them. So learning, I feel, is just the whole systems. We can get into that. It's another topic. That could be a whole nother podcast. But the whole learning system from day one was corrupt, you know? Even how we use senses, right? With the cadets at the police department I was telling you about that I work in that with my company, it was like 60 of them, right? And we were talking about different things. And one of the challenges, I always, obviously, mind, body, one, I try to stimulate their mind in all types of ways, whether it's cognitive training, mindset training, or just learning. So I asked, simple question, you think, but it was kind of a trick. I said, how many senses do we have? Everyone's like, 5, no, 6, no, 7, no, 5. So I'm like, okay, which one is it? So they all agreed, 6. So I'm like, all right, we got 6. All right, let's go with that. And then I said, what are they? Took a few minutes. Seeing, touch, taste, blah, blah, blah. So I said, well, you're wrong. And like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Oh, I knew there was 7. Like, actually, they say it's between maybe 13 and 20, depending on what you classify as a sense, right? Because proprioception, you're a fitness guy. You probably heard that term before. Your awareness of your body in space. That's a sense. Nociception, the sensation of pain, the sensation of temperature. You can maybe put that under touch or feel, but it could be its own thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like we limit ourselves so much as humans. And I guess it's going back to what we said before. What's the least inconvenient way to look at this thing? Well, if I'm just going to learn by seeing, I don't have to worry about all those other things. If I only got to worry about being good at, oh, I have a great hearing, but my eyesight sucks. Well, maybe you need to practice on your visual scanning. You can improve this. And it's like going into the newly health conscious. I'm more, I guess I'm going to piggyback. I'm like the newly performance abled. Like that's more my side. I'm giving you the way to be able to perform, right? So we our thoughts complement each other a lot. So you got me thinking right now. You put me on a little. Yeah. I was on my pulpit for a little bit.
Nah, I love that, man. I love that. I think it's all valuable, man. I think it's all valuable. And back to, because I feel burdened and unjustified if I don't practice what I preach. I want to not only be able to out when I make a video and it's out, I almost feel a sense of like silliness, I guess I can say, if I'm not able to recall what I just talked about, because I spent countless hours studying it, countless hours editing on the topic. So I probably heard myself say it over and over and over to get the edit through, and then it's out, and then 2.5 weeks later, I can't remember the name of that one thing or that one mechanism I was talking about. And that is not what only makes me feel a little silly, but makes it feel like I don't want to just push this stuff out so it could be a one and done. I want to be able to retain this information. Mm-hmm. So I actually have to find myself sacrificing some of my free time to study. And I don't think there's anything like it's fun in a certain degree, right? It's not rewarding in the moment. It's not like so stimulating to where it's like watching Netflix or playing a video game, but I'm choosing to study instead of those things in certain times because I realize at the end of the day, this is what's going to help me grow and develop in my area of expertise and my area of where I want to succeed or my business, right? And that's where I would apply that is understanding the burden I feel to my audience and the burden I feel to even me just being the person that I visualize myself being. I see myself being a certain well-studied guy. And it's like, you're not going to just be that by accident. I'll put it this way. I say life is a lot like the stock market. Let's say I want to withdraw X, let's say $1 million in a certain amount of time in 25 years. I'm not just going to get there by accident. 25 years from now, I'm not just going to be like, all right, I deposited to the stock market here and there, or maybe one good time when I was feeling it, and now I'm ready for my million. It's just not going to be there, right? It just doesn't work like that. You have to make continual regular deposits over time so that you can actually extract and withdraw that $1 million. Yep. I want to be able to box jump 15 inches when I'm 80. That's a real life goal of mine, but it's not going to happen when I'm 80 by accident. I'm not just going to wake up one day I'm 80 and be like, all right, let's give this a shot. No, I have to make continual regular deposits on these bones and these muscles and be able to withdraw that goal once I'm there. And I think for me, I had to sit down and be real with myself. In order to get to where you want to be, you have to make continual, regular deposits, right? You want to be well-studied? Study continually, regularly. And then over time, you actually see yourself being the person that you want to be.
Man, that was some good stuff. I already told you I love analogies. That's literally what we kicked off with this. And
I love them, man.
That's a perfect one. And that being able to box jump at 80, at least 15 inches, that's something like, we could say right now as able-bodied younger men that, okay. But it's like when we get there, it's like, dang, that might be pretty hard. And it, like you said, it don't happen from being 77. It's like, all right, I've had 30 years of nothing. I got 3 years to get these. And you can barely pick up your knees. So I highly doubt that. But that's so real because if we bring this back to like just longevity, whether it be physical, mental, that's the biggest predictor is what you were doing 40, 30 years old. That's what predicts people who get Alzheimer's, dementia, osteoporosis. All that is preceded by 20, 30, 40 years of sedentary life. And you're in the fitness industry. I've been in the fitness industry. It's like I've done thousands of body scans on the body composition assessment. I've done fitness tests. And it's like you'd be surprised how many people I've seen. Like people hear that number, right? 70% of America is overweight or obese. I can literally tell you firsthand. I've been on the front lines. It's not a pretty picture. I don't want to sound morbid, but this is real life. And I've seen people, I had to look them in the eye and be like, you have some work to do. I can't laugh. I can't sugarcoat it. I have to be like, hey, 48% body fat at 31 years old. We got to get this. Because guess what? It's only going to get harder from then on. And then you're 55. You're not going to be able to work out. Then you're going to be 80. You dang sure ain't getting no 15-inch box jump. So, wow. That's some powerful stuff, man. And one more thing on that note, because it's funny how all these, like I said, in the when I emailed you and it was like, we just let it flow. And it's kind of like they all woven with each other because one of the topics, I guess we'll wrap up with this one, was can intellect or does intellect guarantee success? And what you just said goes into that with the stock market analogy because you're a smart guy, but at the same time you said, I love learning. I didn't always understand everything. So I had to figure out how to understand it. Everything you said is the recipe for a person to have that quote unquote future success because intellect only gets you to the table, right? There's plenty of people I'm sure that were in your class because I know that there were some in mine that were A students, they knew every answer to everything. And I see them on social media, not saying they're doing horrible, but they're not where you would think they would be given their straight A's or their cum laude or whatever it is. So what's your thoughts on that whole intelligence and gifted programs at young ages and how it could be a hindrance maybe to future success?
Intelligence to me is the amount of the subject matter that you actually know and understand that you can recall and say, hey, this is this. So for example, anthropology is a subject and the people who study that are probably able to talk a whole lot about culture. They're talking a whole lot about history, and they know a lot about what they're studying. And I'd call them highly intellectual. But you put them in the room full of psychologists who study something totally different, then their intelligence level may dip relative to the psychologists for that subject matter. But that doesn't negate the smartness of the psychologist or the anthropologist. They're both smart. I think intelligence is applied knowledge of the actual subject matter. So in order to succeed, like you said, you don't want to be somebody who has the intel. Like you said, that gets you at the table. But there's a whole nother, we're talking a whole nother component of ethic and skill it actually takes to be able to achieve something and get to a goal. And it has a lot to do with, like you said, the pressures of life is really what allows, it's really what makes people so lazy in a sense, right? And I'm using the word lazy as a very in a very literal sense. I'm literally talking about the folks that choose the path of least resistance the most often. So you think about those highly intellectual people who are who, like you said, you see them on your page now, and you think they'd probably be a little bit something greater than where they are or in a different position. And I almost always resort back to the chances and the opportunity that life gives us. Are we taking advantage of those, or are we kind of letting them by? And this is what I realized. I have another analogy. Let's say you have two carpenters. One carpenter is going to go out and collect wood only when it's convenient. The sun's got to be out. The wood's got to be dry. It's got to be perfect conditions. Then he'll go collect some wood. Second carpenter, he does not care if it's convenient or inconvenient. He's going to go out whether it's rain, shine, sleet, snow. The wood could be wet. It could be low quality. Doesn't matter the conditions. He's going to go out and collect wood. He's agreed that the convenience level does not matter. Over a year's time, the second carpenter, who doesn't care about inconvenience, is going to have enough wood to build a house. The first is going to have enough wood to maybe start a campfire. And you think about the difference between the two people. It's just his willingness to accept inconvenience. I have a phrase, inconvenience is incoming. If you can just ingrain that in your head, I truly believe that you'll be able to achieve that goal of yours, because that's the other component, right? If we're baking that cake, we're talking about that level of agreeing that there's inconvenience, and then there's the actual intellect. If you can agree those two or reconcile those two, I think that's when you start to see folks who really are achieving something great. So you think about the mega stars. You're talking about, you know, the Beyoncés, the Jay-Z's, the Michael Jacksons have just thought of entertainment, but you can go athletics with Serena Williams, Tiger Woods. And obviously, you know, a thing or two about people who become excellent at their sport, LeBron James, you know. So I think you never hear stories of them. You never hear them tell their come up without saying, like, I had to commit to this. And I just don't think we're able to do that without consciously agreeing that there's going to be that inconvenience.
It's funny that that is the same thing that you say people hear to come up, struggle, inconvenience, and they get it. And that they'll commend these people you just named. Like, oh my God, how did LeBron or Michael Jack, whoever, overcome that? But in the same breath, look at their own life and not do that. I see this firsthand because in the mental side of my business, I've consulted with corporations, athletes, military, and you'd be surprised some of the people you would call hardcore or whatever, and their mindset is the opposite of what you just said. And it's like, but you know it takes this type of work. You know that it's not always going to be sunshine and rainbow, but yet we don't do it. So I'm going to use that they don't want that inconvenience.
Still at all. It's comfortable, man. It's comfortable. People don't want to leave their comfort zone. And I, you know, we're all susceptible to this. I'm not saying this from a lofty position. Mm-hmm. This is something that I'm just aware of. Therefore, I was able to combat it. And that's what it is, because it doesn't even matter the industry. I look at some YouTubers who are huge, like Marques Brownlee. If you guys don't know his name, MKBHD, he's a tech reviewer. I guarantee if you don't know his name, you've probably seen his face. He's the only, like, he's a black reviewer, and he reviews, he's the biggest YouTube reviewer when it comes to like tech and stuff. And I look at people like him and I'm like, even he had to hustle. I'm sure he didn't grow and amass tens of millions of followers by just kind of doing this when it was convenient for him or when he felt like it, right? I think of anybody in these industries, rather it's entrepreneurial, rather it's in a corporation, in order for you to be something notable, I think you do have to tap into that side where it's like, I don't really want to go based on my feelings right now. I want to actually go and achieve the dang thing. And I think that's what it takes.
It does. And I can say this from my own personal experience. Like, there's been situations where I had to literally put myself in a super hole physically, mentally, and financially, because I knew the outcome, maybe not today or tomorrow, I knew it would be at minimum. This is a literal experience. I can't go into too detail, but it was like a 7-month period. And I knew I knew all the hardships, and I went through every last one of them to get to where I'm at now with this contract I mentioned. So this just happened, and it was like, I know for a fact, and this is toot my own horn, I know most people would have given up, because it's like the inconvenience. Like, I had to do things for free knowing that I don't have the resources for it. Like, there's times where I was like, I do not have this in my account to make this happen on this side, but I got to go do it anyway. And then I had other things to tend to. And that's just something, people going back to that comfort, I think it's comfort for sure. And I think it's also that there's this assumption that we deserve an outcome for every action, like a reward or a dessert, like, here you go, you did A, you get B. No, sometimes you get -7 and you're like, wait, that's a number, but that's how it goes. I just took it algebra indirectly, but it's like, that's how it has to go. And people, it's cliche, we can say it, they don't want their comfort zone, but it really is that, or they do want their comfort zone. It really is that.
Yeah. And it's a subconscious thing, because, naturally you're going to do what comes easier. We just do that naturally. So I don't fault people, but I do tell people, I do not care about what you want to do. Like, I tell my guys all the time, don't tell me what you want to do. Do it. Like, I have I shouldn't say pet peeve, because I don't want to sound like I'm in a lofty position. Mm-hmm. I think to get things done, there does have to be a little bit of Nike behind it. You know what I mean? There has to be a little bit of Just Do It behind it. And that's why I don't want to hear about people's plans sometimes. And I'm like, I much rather you show me the results or the effects of you taking action and doing it rather than you talk about it in this moment. And I don't fault people, because we live in a world that's just highly inconvenient, and naturally going against that pressure, it's tough. That's why you got people who take like cold showers and stuff. Like, they say that there's, now cold showers is nothing I dived into the research wise, but a lot of people say they take cold showers so they can build up the mental fortitude to do things they don't feel like doing. I tried, it's not me. I don't do cold showers, me personally. But one thing I do is when I'm working at my desk, I try not to be sedentary for over 30 minutes. So I set a timer and I Pomodoro my work every 30 minutes. I'm going to get up and I'm going to go and just move. Rather, I'm stretching, I may knock out some squats or some pushups. I'm going to move for 5 minutes and then get back to work. There's times I don't want to get up from my desk. I'm like, oh, the timer went off, I don't want to move. But I still go and do it, because I'm telling myself, it's just because you feel that way does not necessarily mean that it's the right course of action, right? You still have a goal in mind. You want that longevity, you want that health, you don't want to be a sedentary worker, then you have to get up and move, right? So that's where that's where that logic applies in my mind.
Nice. 100%. We can go on this topic all day, because we're both very driven individuals.
We could talk all day, brother.
And it's like, I I'm about to go into another one, but I won't. But basically, just all in all, the main idea, that's why the goal of this podcast is to obviously bring the subject matter expert, because I've had people like yourself, had psychologists, military people, but the end goal is always, how can I put my mind to whatever it is? And I feel we've dropped, you've especially dropped quite a few good points. And I usually end with the take home too. I don't know if I was doing that when we first did the podcast, but I've been doing it everyone since. And it's kind of like, do I even want to do the take home too? Because you gave them like the take home 20, but I'm gonna do it anyway. So come up with two more. You have about a few seconds, think about it. So take home two, just generally, two key points, could be whether it's a quick phrase, a thought, whatever it is, advice, suggestion, two things to leave the audience that they can go right now, turn this off. They heard just this. Let's say they only heard this two. They can go and put it in effect. Take home two.
Okay. I think I got two. Part of the reason I dropped so many gems is because I'm a deep thinker. So it's like I'm always like in my spare time or when I'm going on a walk or when I'm just driving, these things just come up and I actually flesh them out in the moment. So I'm nothing special in terms of like the way I see things or view things. I just take the time to flesh out my ideas because a lot of people have really good ideas. They just kind of let them pass. So I have these really good like philosophical things that come up in my mind. For example, like the carpenter analogy, like I wanted to find a way to explain inconvenience and how it hinders us, but I needed to connect for not only me, but when I communicated for other people. So I'm like carpenters. And I actually sat down and wrote that out. So those are things that I do. So I don't give myself the opportunity to sit down and talk enough. That's why I'm on 10 right now with you. But to actually answer the question,
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, let's go.
Because this was on the sheet, and I think I got to attack it now because of what you just said. Introversion and extroversion. Because a big myth is that introverts are deep thinkers that are only to themselves and don't want to be around people, and extroverts aren't deep thinkers or shallow. They just want to talk to people and have a good time, and both are wrong. So I kind of want to explore that now because I want to ask you, if you were to pick one more to the other, what would you put yourself on? Introvert or extrovert?
Because of the nature of my job, I spend a fair amount of time in solitude. But the last thing that made sense in terms of somebody defining introvert and extrovert to me, they were talking about where you get your energy from.
Yep.
So based on that, and I want you to explain it too. Because you'd know more, but I think I'm more of an extrovert because I find myself being re-energized from people. If I were to sit in my room and work on videos for a week straight without human interaction, by the end of the week, I'd probably like run downtown and just meet a stranger because just out of sheer, like I need human connection right now. But I know other people, that's not necessarily the case. I need to talk to people, connect with people. So I definitely say I'm more of an extrovert. And then, that's what I'd say for that.
Well, that goes to the point of the myth, because you being extrovert does not negate the fact that you're a very deep thinker. You can be in within your own thoughts. But it's what you said, though. It's where you're most comfortable, where you adjust and adapt the best. So an extrovert can be to himself or their self, when an introvert can be outgoing in the life of the scene. But it's just that, will they feel more comfortable there? Like, I'm actually very introverted, but I had a lady the other day say, "You're not introverted. You're so lively because we're talking about this stuff." And I laughed and I said, "Look where I'm at. I'm in my setting. If you had caught me in a party or something that wasn't this, I probably wouldn't be the one in everyone's face." But guess what? I can talk to people. I do it every day, but I feel like I ran a marathon. That's just how I feel. Even when it's stuff I like, I just feel like I read a marathon. I'm like, oh my gosh. And you go sit down. And I'm not even joking. I really have to, like, when I used to teach, it was hard for me for the first few years because the class would think that I'm this extroverted. Oh yeah, he talks and loves the subject. But it's like, nah, I just got to play this character like a mask almost. So yeah, with you, I can see you being extroverted. But guess what? The name of the game isn't, am I this or that? It's like, can I utilize it when I need it? That's the best performers in any field. In sport, music, obviously, definitely music, business are the ones who can shift it. And we both have to do that. Like, you're behind the camera. Like, what we're both doing right now, we're both by ourselves. There's no camera. People say, who shoots your video? Like, me. That's tripod. And it's like, I'm by myself a lot, too, other than when I'm on site with a contract. But at the same time, when I'm on site with a contract, I gotta talk to higher-ups, people who are movers and shakers. So I can't be, like, awkward. I have to learn how to adapt. And that's what it's all about when it comes to personality theories. Like you say, getting your energy, I got to learn how to get a little more energy in a social situation. So the best way I do it personally, my advice to people is find out a way to like focus on the moment. Because a lot of times when we get in that awkward, like, oh, social awkwardness, you start veering away mentally. And it's like, man, are they wondering what I look like or what I think versus being in the moment? Because then you start getting that awkward, like looking away, and then you lost them. Now they're like, wait, what are they doing? So I always tell people, you got to act even more. It sounds weird to say, not fake, I'm not saying fake, but act more interested in a way in your head, not outwardly, because I don't want you to be like, hey, yeah, yeah, like, but more so like in your head.
Oh boy.
Overly address the interaction, because if you don't, you're going to find yourself veering away and it might seem like you're standoffish. And then you, if it's business, you lose a business deal. If it's sports, you look weak. If it's a performance with music, you don't get a good performance. Mm. So that's why I want to touch on it, because I was like, hey, we're going to close out.
Fascinating.
But yeah, I've actually published my own paper on this. That's why I really want to touch it, because there's a lot of links with extroversion and confidence and mental toughness, because going back to that social situation where if you got to be around people and perform, it would make sense that you get energy. So think about someone who's introverted. They could still be the top baseball player or football player, but think about when all the lights are on you and it's like, so last free throw, the whole stadium is screaming your name, whether it's good things or bad things. Make it, Johnny, make it. Miss it, Johnny, miss it. Whatever it is, it's you. And if you're introverted, that might be hard, because now you're thinking like, dang, everyone's going for me, versus like an extroverted person, like, yeah, they're going for me. Or if they're hating, okay, I'm cool with that. I like that. So it affects. Yeah. So studies have shown that the more extroverted person tends to be, this was mostly with sports, but it carries over to a lot of things, tends to be the more higher performer. So that's why introverted people have to learn these traits. That's why, have you ever met a person, and it's not every tech person, but a tech person, they tend to be on the highly introverted side. Not all of them. There's some that can talk and speak. But when I say introvert, I'm not just talking about they're not one to interact. They're literally like, they're very uncomfortable. They're short. They almost come off as if they don't like you. And that might not be the case. So people like that, they got to learn these skills, because I have a few apps I'm developing and I've learned it firsthand that they do not know how to deal with people a lot of times. Not all, but a lot of times. So these are skills, just like the other things we talked about, creativity, deliberate practice. All this is coachable, learnable. This is why you have a thriving YouTube channel. This is why my business is growing, because we indirectly and directly do these. So people watching, hey, y'all got some good game today.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to break that down too, the extrovert and introvert conversation. I learned a lot just now. Very interesting. You know what I thought of? Because you brought up sports, and I thought of people consider Derrick Rose to be introverted, and I don't know the guy personally, but he's going to go down in the Hall of Fame. He does really well against his peers. He hits clutch shots. But then you think of somebody like Kevin Garnett, who is obnoxious and very vocal on the court, and he's going down in the Hall of Fame. He's hit clutch shots, and you know, people might consider him more extroverted, but there's more nuance to it than that, and I never thought of that, so it's very interesting.
Yeah, I would look like, because I'm more of a baseball, football, track guy, so I obviously know both those players, but I would ask you, since you know a little more, is when they're in certain clutch situations, when there's certain like not as clutch situations, I would be more aware of how are they performing, scoring, even their disposition, because you can see them on TV. So you can see, are they more like calmer when it should be more hype? Are they more hype when it should be more calm? These all play to your performance, right? And that's the thing. Everyone has a different level of that threshold. Some people, an extroverted person needs that crowd going crazy, while Derrick Rose, maybe he'll perform just as good if it's people in the bathroom getting the hot dogs and the game's on the line and people are just checked out because it's not a big game. He might still play just the same because he didn't need all that attention, you know? So these are just things that you made me think about now when it comes to that.
That's dope.
But yeah, so.
That's dope.
Should we do the take home too, or we wrap it up there? What do you think?
did I give the take home?
No, I interrupted you. My bad. Cause I was like, I wanted to touch that extroversion.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It was worth it. Totally worth it to hit that corner. Yes, take home too. So my number one is embracing convenience. Doesn't mean you have to be perfect. I've struggled with perfectionism for a season, and I've learned to give myself grace. I've applied it, and I'm still continually learning and growing in that regard. But I do not let myself, I don't let up. So embracing convenience, because you realize that's what you got to do to achieve things in this world. And then the second thing I'd say is, watch out for your expertise. So how can I frame that in a more interesting way? So be vigilant of, or since we did, I guess we can talk about that instead. I'll scratch that. Embrace the convenience. And the second thing I say is be vigilant of what you're consuming online, in terms of the intentions of the people who are pushing content out to you, right? If you can't really read their heart, I think you should be skeptical, and then you should probably assess your next actions in terms of if you're about to buy something or anything like that. Get more context. So yeah, that's what I'd say.
The context.
This was so fun.
Of course, but I'm getting energy from this. Feel me? Because this is where I thrive. You know. But we're talking about the game, for example. I probably wouldn't get as much energy. And I'm in the sport. That's the funny thing. People say you're in the sport world a lot. Like I have a term from a guy named Justin Sua. He's a mental coach. He was with the Tampa Bay Rays. Now he has his own. Well, he's already had his own business, but now he's doing his own thing now. And he's a highly sought after mental coach. Works with Fortune 500 companies, and he said a term that he's sport agnostic, and I started using it too because I said I like that because I don't really have the right to even be biased in teams and sports because I have people from other ones. So it's like if I like this team, I might have a player on this team. So I get my energy more from these conversations. I'm not going to talk about the Heat game or whatever. That's the team down here, but it's like I'm not opposed to it, but I get my energy for talking about this stuff. That's why. It's always like I live here. And it's like he can't because that's the only time people see me because social media, right? They don't know me personally, but every time they see me, it's talking about this stuff. So all in all, that was good. Context is definitely needed because without that, we're going to think everything's a cure-all, fix-all because of a simple cosign from either expert and or even worse, a celebrity who just has a lot of following. That's even worse than an expert, you know, we can get into that. So put where to find you at, social media, YouTube, of course. I'll put it on the screen and we can check out.
Yeah. You can just Google No Lab Court Required. Hopefully my Instagram comes up. Hopefully my YouTube comes up, depending on how big I am right now. Or you could just go to YouTube and search it up directly. If you do want to support me, these hats are available. There's the two-tone one that I'm wearing. And then there's the there's an all-black Do More Listening hat if you're interested in copping some merch. But other than that, man, I just enjoy when people come by and they learn and they let me know that they learn. So that's my whole spiel. This was fun, Nick. Appreciate it.
All right, no problem at all. I'm gonna have to check out the hats. I don't really wear hats like that, but I might have to get one just to support either way. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. This is great as always, and as always, get your mind right.